sin is addictive. The very nature of sin is its addictive character. So even though we know that sin is bad for us, and even though we know that sin damages the people around us, we keep doing it. In our hearts, we say, yeah, I want to be loving and kind and generous and just and moral. But then we turn around and we say and do things that are unloving and unkind and greedy and unjust and immoral. We know that as Christians, the way to deal with sin in terms of its eternal consequence is to commit to Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. And thereby, we ultimately have our sins forgiven and we are guaranteed a place in heaven. But how do we live holy lives between now and then? Well, think of it this way. During your teens, you rebelled big time against your parents. You did and said everything that was contrary to their teaching and to their values and beliefs. You resented their love. You ran away from home. You stole money from your parents. You were so distanced from them that you even changed your name so that you wouldn't be associated with them anymore. And although you may not choose to use the words, pretty much it's accurate to say you hated them. But more recently, they have reached out to you. They've brought you back home again. They paid the money to go back to court and have your name legally changed to match their name. They've set up a trust for you, a trust from which you can withdraw significant amounts of money. And everything is going great. Except last night, in the dark of the night, you fell back into old habits. You sneaked around the house until you found your dad's wallet and you stole $20 out of it. And then at 2 o'clock this morning, you opened the window and you climbed out the side of the house and you ran away from home just like you did before. Now this is crazy, especially now that you're 52 years old. And it's kind of like that with God. God is our Father. He loves us. We're part of His family, and we've rebelled against His family. Changed our names. Hated Him. Don't want to be associated with Him. Contrary to His values and beliefs. But God has pursued us. God has brought us back home again. He set up a trust, and in that trust is a deed to property in heaven itself. And He's changed our name back, and we've agreed to it. And we're called Christians to identify with Him and His Son and His family. Except what do? We sneak out on God, and we return to old sinful patterns again and again. I think that St. Peter had the same problem. And I think it was out of his own personal experience that he wrote to us and gave to us the 13th of the 20 principles that he writes in the New Testament. Principles for successful living in tough times. And this principle is to live to overcome sin and to do the will of God. Here's the way he explained it. Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with this same attitude, because he who has suffered in his body is done with sin. As a result, he does not live the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. They think it strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. But they will have to give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is the reason the gospel was preached, even to those who are now dead, so that they might be judged according to men in regard to the body, but live according to God in regard to the spirit. So it starts out by saying, adopt the attitude of Jesus. And Jesus' attitude towards sin is pretty well known. He's against it. In fact, so much against sin that Jesus decided that he would die in order to deal with it. Jesus saw and sees sin for what it is, temporarily most appealing, but ultimately destructive. Jesus knew and knows that sin is bad stuff. It makes people sick. It destroys relationships. It causes crimes and wars and a multitude of other problems. The greatest of these problems is that it alienates us from God. So he writes, therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude that Jesus had. Because he who has suffered in his body is done with sin. The United States of America and the people of this nation were deeply offended by what happened on September 11, 2001. So offended that corporately as a nation, we decided that we were willing to do just about anything and pay any price to stop this from happening again. And it has already been billions of dollars, inconvenience in terms of security, and the cost of the lives of American men and women soldiers. And our attitude is that we will pay any price and do anything to just stop terrorism. We just don't want our lives controlled by terrorism ever again. Now, Jesus had the same attitude towards sin. He sees what sin does, and he does not want that controlling our lives. And so he stepped up and said, any price to do this, to stop it from happening. So there's no doubt about Jesus' attitude. And if we want to stop sin habits, then we need to have that same attitude of hating sin. We don't rationalize it. We don't call it by some nice name. We call sin, sin. Now, Jesus' attitude led to Jesus' action, and his action was that he suffered. He suffered to stop sin. Now, in Jesus' case, that turned out for enormous good. And the teaching here is that the same thing can happen to us. The Bible explains that sin is like this pervasive virus. It's like a virus in our bodies that is systemic and affects the entire body. It's like a virus in a computer system that starts out in one computer, but as that computer has contact with other computers, it eventually goes through all the networks and corrupts every contact that is made. That sin is like that. And we then suffer the consequences, whether on a computer or in our own bodies. And when we suffer, we've got to decide, what does that suffering do to us in terms of the way we think and behave? We suffer crimes, sickness, divorce, broken relationships, lost jobs, war, all these things because of sin, either directly or indirectly. When we adopt the attitude of Jesus towards sin, we say, that's enough. I've suffered enough. I hate this stuff, and I want no more to do with it. That does not mean that we are instantly perfect and holy, because the residual effects of the virus of sin continues throughout our lives. But it is to say that when we suffer the consequences, when we get sick, when someone we love dies, that our choice is not to turn against God and say, God, where were you? Why did you mess this up? But to turn against the virus of sin and say, I've had it with this. I want to be done with it. I want no more of it. That is to say, then, that the suffering in our own lives causes us to all the more repudiate sin and be finished with it. That just as Jesus' suffering fought against sin, let our suffering shape our attitudes and turn us against sin. Since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude, because he or she, we, who have suffered in our bodies, then choose to be done with this stuff, done with sin. Now, less sin is good, very good, but it's not good enough. Because even if we could get rid of all of the sin that is in our lives, the best that would do would be to bring us up to zero. And what good is that? So we've gotten rid of the problem, but that doesn't mean that we're doing any good. So Peter writes on in 1 Peter 4:2, as a result, the Christian does not live the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. So Peter talks about the rest of our earthly lives and raises the question of what we are going to do with them. A week or so ago, I saw a short article about a website that I wish I had kept the address of, but unfortunately I didn't, that you can go to and you can find out when you're going to die. And what you do is you go to this website, you know, when you've got a slow day, and you can fill in these various windows. So you put in your date of birth, you put in your gender, if you have any significant illness, do you smoke, do you drink? You answer these questions, and then you click, and it tells you the exact date, hour, and minute when you are going to die. Now, here's the really cool feature. It gives you a clock that is a rundown clock. So it starts now and then constantly clicks off the seconds and the minutes and the hours. So you can sort of miniaturize this on your computer screen, and you can do all your other work and keep glancing over there and see how much life you've got left. So, you know, you've used up a half an hour, you've used up 7 days, you can just keep clicking it down. Now, I'm not quite sure why anybody would want to do that, but if you did, what you would be doing is tapping into reality, because that is exactly what reality is for our lives. We've got a limited amount of time left. All of us have so many years or months or days or hours, and they are clicking off. So this time next week, there will be 7 days that have gone that we can never recapture. They're gone forever. They're done. Our lives have finished that much more. And the question here is, what are we going to do with whatever we have left? And the New Testament is saying, don't fill what's left with just living out evil desires. Do something good with whatever you have left. That the absence of evil is never enough for Christians. That there needs to be a fulfillment of the will of God. Now, the Old Testament prophet Micah raised the question, okay, so what is that? What do we do with the rest of our lives, and what is the will of God? What does the Lord require of us? To act justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So hooray for those who avoid sin. That's not enough. Do good. Do the will of God. Click off the rest of the life that we have, saying this is what we will do with what God has given us that is left. But let's get more personal about this. In your neighborhood, what do you think would really delight the heart of God? In your place of employment, what does God want to happen there in the next 12 months? At your home, what would be God's dream for something really positive, sort of make God's day? In your life, what does God want? To answer those questions and then say, okay, God, I'll step up, and with whatever is left of the reducing number of the days and hours that I have, that is what I will commit to do. That as the clock of life ticks down, the Christian does not live the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. Now, Peter writes on, and he tackles a problem that is faced by every biblical writer. And that is the tension between the stating of the principle and the giving of specifics. And throughout the Bible, that is a tension. For when principles are given, what happens is that many people say, oh, well, I don't know how that applies to my life. So we blow it off and don't do it. But when specifics are given, we get in legalistic arguments about the specific. And I'll give you some examples. From the very beginning of the Bible, we are told the Sabbath principle, and that is don't work 7 days a week, take some time off for rest. The principle was given, and basically what our human predecessors did was work around the calendar. No time was taken off. So God said, all right, I'll give you specifics so you understand what the principle is. And he gave a commandment. Actually, it was one of his top 10. And he said, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And then what happened? People said, well, what do you mean by day? I mean, is that 24 hours? Because actually, it's not 24 hours. It's 23 hours, 59 minutes, 59 point some seconds. Are you talking midnight to midnight? Are you talking sunset to sunset? What if your cow gets sick? So do you rest on that day, or can you help your cow who's sick? And all the argument moved away from the principle into the specific. Same thing happened with money. The principle is God has blessed us, be generous with what we have, returning some to God and blessing others. People didn't do it, didn't follow the principle. So God said, all right, I'll be specific. Give away 10% of your money. And then people said, 10% of gross or 10% of net? And on the legalistic argument goes. Or it's about sex. God says, here's the principle. I've given sex as this wonderful gift to be enjoyed in pleasure within a marriage relationship. And then people come and say, well, what if we're not married, and just exactly how far can you go, and how much intimacy can we have? Can we go right up to but not including intercourse, or, you know, are we not supposed to hold hands? What are we talking about here? You know, probably these things are not all that hard to figure out, but here's the specifics that Peter gives to flesh out the principle of living to overcome sin and to do the will of God. If you've spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry, they think it strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. But they will have to give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is the reason the gospel was preached, even to those who are now dead, so that they might be judged according to men in regard to the body, but live according to God in regard to the Spirit. So Peter gets specific. But don't turn this into a legal contract or a criminal code. He's telling them, you guys used to be pagans. You remember what that was like. You were drunk all the time. You were sexually promiscuous. You were doing things that were so detestable that they were even against the laws of the Roman Empire, which were largely immoral laws. And Peter's saying, don't live like that. You remember that? Just don't be like that. Stay sober. Be moral. Quit the wild stuff. And most of his readers then and now knew exactly what that meant. But what about the old party buddies? What about those that we used to do all this with? Aren't they going to say, so what's the matter with you? You know, what happened to you? Aren't you going to join us? Aren't you going to party with us? Don't you want to have some fun? And they then can become abusive because somehow they feel that they have been rejected. And so there are dirty practical jokes and rumors that are started and mean things that are said because they can't stand the idea of someone adopting a different lifestyle from the one that they live. And suddenly that hurts us and we feel rejected. These are our relatives and our friends. These are our fraternity brothers and sorority sisters. These are people we want to like us. They're our co-workers. So what are we going to do? After a long, hard day at work or after a softball game or to celebrate an election victory, are we going to join the old gang in the partying that God calls us not to do? And so we've got to decide. And Peter says, just keep going back to the principle. And the principle is to live a life that overcomes sin and fill the rest of your life with doing the will of God. And he explains, we're going to be held accountable. Everybody is. That God has a judgment coming for those who are Christians and those who are pagans. For some, it is swift and obvious, and for others, it may not come until the end of a lifetime. But one thing is for sure, and that is that God judges us all. Then he finishes up this principle by remembering some Christians who have already died because they have stood for what is right and sought to overcome sin and to do the will of God. And this was a sensitive subject in the first century church because they were sitting next to empty seats that used to be filled with their family members who had died because they were Christians. And it wasn't just a first century thing, so don't write this off as 2,000 years ago. This past week in Washington, it was my privilege to host a summit on Christian persecution, or persecution against Christians in the Sudan and North Korea. It was a series of presentations, six of them by members of the United States Congress, representatives of those who have themselves suffered terrible torture and persecution in the Sudan and North Korea, a representative of the White House that came and read a specific letter signed by the President of the United States. And my heart is just filled with the stories that there were told. That in the Sudan, 2.1 million people have died, most of them simply because of their Christian faith. The government sending in helicopter gunships to shoot down families, including children, from the air. But the main tactic is starvation. That even if the United States and European countries send food, the army makes sure that it doesn't get to Christians, and they have died by the hundreds of thousands by starvation. In North Korea, the treatment of Christians is so abominable that some of them have tried to escape the country by crossing the border into China. But an agreement between the North Korean government and the Chinese government is that the Chinese soldiers then hunt down these Christians and put wires through their noses and pull them back across the border into North Korea, where they are sentenced to a minimum of 7 years in concentration camps for re-education to purge them of their Christianity. And so these words aren't just words of a long time ago in the first century. These are words for the 21st century. For this is the reason the gospel was preached even to those who are now dead because of their faith in Jesus Christ, so that they might be judged according to men in regard to the body, that is physically, but according to God in regard to the spirit. He's saying that God isn't going to let evil people get away with these kinds of things, these persecutors, that God isn't going to let the martyrs go unrewarded, that God is going to judge us all, the living and the dead, those who heard the gospel and believed and those who didn't. Sometimes when we hear all of this stuff from the Bible, we say, yeah, but I can't help it. That's just not true. Just as pagans make a deliberate choice and action to sin, Christians make a deliberate choice and action not to sin. And so here is the call of the Bible, to live like a Christian, that as the clock of life ticks down, live to overcome sin, and live to do the will of God with whatever time is left. Our Father, our hearts go out to those who suffer. But we also suffer in different and lesser ways. Help us to turn suffering to a hatred of sin. Help us to overcome sin in our own lives and to overcome sin around us. But God, may that not be all of it. May it also be that we seek to do that which is good and right. May we have a heart for the will of God, and may we live out your will in all the time we have left. For Jesus' sake. From the brakes. He stops the restraint that he has had on human sinfulness throughout history, and he allows human sin to begin to go toward its sinful worst. That God no longer stops this large sword of war. God allows the rider of evil to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. So if I correctly envision what is here described, it means that at this time there will be eruption of wars everywhere. Civil wars within nations that have previously been united and at peace. Wars between nations and individuals. It will be a time when peace will be nothing more than a sweet memory of the past. After the red horse of slaughter comes the black horse of war's consequences. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a day's wages, and 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine." Which is to say that when there is war, there is disruption of production and distribution. That's because farmers are killed, roads are destroyed, ships are sunk, economies go into tailspins. I mean, you start thinking about it. What would happen, you just imagine, if world war began today? Probably, there would no longer be the shipping of oil from the Middle East. What would that do to the United States and to our lives? Probably, it would no longer be possible for the wheat that is grown in Minnesota and the heartland of America to be distributed to North Korea and Afghanistan and Africa and places where there is potential mass starvation. What if on a single day, or even in a single month, there were a breakdown of telecommunication and rail travel and shipping and trucking and commercial aviation? You'd go to the grocery store to buy food. There wouldn't be any food there, because how would food get there? On the evening of last September 11th, I went to the gas station to fill the tank of my car.
got there, and there was nobody there, and there was a sign written on a piece of paper, handwritten, saying they were out of gas. The station was closed. Maybe they'd get some more the next day. So here in Eden Prairie, I drove to another gas station, and the line was so long, I couldn't find the end of the line. So I left, and I went to a third gas station. And that third gas station, I found the end of the line, so I got in it, waited a long time, got into conversation with the guy in the next car. And he said that he had been about 5 miles west of here, where he was at a gas station where they had raised the price in the last few hours from around $1.50 a gallon to over $5 per gallon. Now, this is before anything much happened. There hadn't been a disruption of supplies or deliveries at that point. This was based upon rumor and threat and worry of what might happen. What if it really did happen? What if we really did have these consequences, serious consequences, from war? You know, most of us don't have farms. We don't even have gardens that we could feed ourselves. We don't have enough food supplies in our kitchens or our garages to get us through any lengthy period of time. Most of us couldn't heat our houses through a few days of the winter if there was a disruption of electricity and natural gas. We don't have the wood or the coal. Many of us don't even have anything that is wood or coal burning within our homes. Could we get to work or to school or anywhere else if we couldn't drive our cars? We don't have horses. We don't have ways of getting there. We don't have electrical generators. And even if you do have an electrical generator, what are the chances that you have enough fuel that you could keep it going for any sustained period of time? With this black horse of the apocalypse comes awful consequences of war. An example is given where a man goes to work, and at the end of the day he gets paid, and he's left with enough money to buy 1 quart of wheat. Now, in those days, a quart of wheat was considered how much food a person needed in order to eat for one day, which is to say that a day's work produced the money for enough food for just the worker. He couldn't feed his family. So the rest of his family had nothing to eat. Or maybe with that day's wages, he could buy 3 quarts of barley. Barley was considered to be cheap food, less nutritious, eaten by the poor and in especially difficult times. What is really interesting is if you take the prices that are described in Revelation 6 and compare them to what we know to be the typical prices in the Roman Empire at the end of the first century, these costs are 12 times what the normal price is. Okay, so you translate that into our economy. What we have described here is that suddenly you wake up one morning, and not only is war raging, but you go to the gas station, and gasoline costs $18 per gallon, or milk is $10 a quart, or bread is $12 a loaf. Or if you want to buy a sort of mid-range to inexpensive new automobile, it'll cost you $300,000. Or if you want to lease an apartment, a 3-bedroom apartment in South Minneapolis or one of the suburbs, you'll need to sign a lease for in excess of $12,000 per month. The consequences of war can be sudden and severe. So what we have here is a painful picture of high inflation and widespread human misery. But there's more. The fourth and the final horseman rides the pale horse of death. When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death. And Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. So this last horse is this sickly color, sort of a grayish green and yellow. It is the color of death. And right behind it is Hades, which was the word for the grave. And to this rider and horse are given the power of death over a fourth of the population. Now, you take that and bring that into today's population numbers, and you're talking worldwide in excess of 1.5 billion people. The death of 1.5 billion people. Or in the United States, that's roughly 75 million Americans dying. You say, well, you know, nothing like that's ever happened. Do you know, actually, something like that has happened. that there are credible records from the Roman Empire, even from medieval England, of plagues that came where more than a fourth, up to a half of the population died in a single plague. And we talk about all our worries about anthrax. Anthrax is minimal when compared to what has already happened in history from influenza, from smallpox, from the bubonic plague. Now, as scary as all these prophecies are, in the book of Revelation, this is just the first scroll. These are just the breaking of the first seals. This is only the beginning. By far, the worst is yet to come. At this point, God still has his foot on the brakes. He's just easing off. You read on in Revelation 6 and all the way through to the end of the book, and it becomes a sobering prediction of the worst that is to occur. You know what's really interesting to me? A couple of months ago, this would have seemed absolutely bizarre. 3 months ago, we would have said, this is about as far-fetched as you can get. These are the crazy thoughts of somebody who lived in ancient times and had a very wild and vivid imagination. And now these things are front page news. They're the cover stories on news magazines. What could really be? And yet the Christians read this when they wanted to be comforted and not scared. When they wanted to have confidence in God. When they wanted to increase their faith and their hope. So, like, what were they thinking? That they would go to this to read in times of trauma? Indeed, they did, because they believed that God was in control of history. When they read these words from Revelation, they said, God knows the future before it happens. And he's in charge. And we can trust him. That God is not caught by surprise. That God is ready for whatever is going to happen. They read these words to increase their faith and their hope because they believed that God would win. You know, I don't pretend to be able to get all the details and all the understanding of all the symbols in the book of Revelation. It's a hard read. I know that. But don't get so caught up in the details that you miss the big message of Revelation, and that is God wins. God wins. That's the message that is there. God is the final victor. The ultimate victory does not go to the Roman Caesar, or to some terrorist, or even to Satan, but to God. And so they believed, and we believe, that God wins and that we are on God's side. So let me say it in very plain words. Do not be afraid, and certainly don't spread fear to other people. Trust God. Live by faith, not by fear. Do you remember in the Old Testament when the Hebrew people were enslaved in Egypt and this series of plagues came? And it affected the Egyptians, but God protected and preserved the Hebrews. If God can do that then for them, he can do that here now for Christians. So live by faith, not by fear. Live with calm and live with confidence. Hear the words that St. Paul wrote to the Romans. What then shall we say in response to this? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. In all these things, we, Christians, us, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. God knows everything. God is completely in charge. God will take care of you. So you don't need to be afraid. Live by faith, not by fear. Our Father, we thank you that you are a God that can be trusted. And we do trust you. We believe in you, so we give to you our worries and our fears and our anxieties. We tell you directly and forthrightly that we trust you now and we will trust you forever. Lord, we tell you that the future, whatever it holds, is one in which we are convinced that we are and will be more than conquerors through Jesus Christ our Lord.